Blog Talk Radio.
Well, and apparently our promo music isn't going to play. Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. This is Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette Online, and this is TS Radio. Our show tonight is Dialysis Advocates and hosted by Arlene Mullen. I want to remind everyone that these shows are brought to you in coordination with the Whistleblower Summit taking place this year, July 29th, 30th, and 31st in Washington, D.C. The summit is open to the public. Everyone is cordially invited, and I hope you can attend. There's a lot going on there. You can do a lot of networking, talk to other whistleblowers and advocates, find out what everybody's doing, and you can make a lot of good connections there for your cause. With that being said, I'll turn this over to your host, Arlene. It's all yours.
Thanks, Marty, and thanks, Marcel, for having us and giving us time on the show. Tonight we have a guest, Dr. Aku, which is a psychologist. And do you want to explain basically your background? I was really impressed.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate being here, and I look forward to helping and supporting your audience as much as I can. My background, I am a licensed clinical psychologist. I've been in the field. I was just sitting here thinking about it as I was listening to your introduction. I think I've been in this field for going on 30 years overall, and I've done a lot of different things in the field, including some history in health psychology, but mostly working with people who are HIV positive back in my early career. These days, a lot of what I do is help people reduce stress in a variety of different ways in a variety of different forms. But mostly I really try to help people deal with stress because we know that no matter what else is going on with you, stress is a big killer. It exacerbates things.
Yeah. You used to work for the police department?
No, I actually currently, one of the things I still do currently is with the police department. I provide workshops for the police, mostly the emergency response unit and the hostage negotiators of the New York City Police Department. I teach them about mental health and mental illness and how to use their words to help people that are in crisis situations. And so that is one of the things that I do a few times a year. And it's one of the most important things that I do because, as we all know, there is a lot of issue with the police and violence against people of color especially. And as a Black female psychologist, I stand up there as an expert. And I bring in Black psychology as much as I can, but also just being there, they get to see a person of color as an expert, and that alone starts to change some of the implicit bias that people have about people of color.
Wow, that has got to be stressful. I mean, you can't have too much go wrong in that.
Yes.
You know?
Well, what's wonderful about the workshops that we do in training the police is we bring in professional actors to act out some real-life scenarios so that the police get to really get an opportunity to practice using words in a safe space before they go out there and do it in the real world. It's the way I deal with my anger at the injustice in the world, as opposed to just being angry. It feels like I'm doing something constructive, and I think that it's important for us who feel angry to find a way to do something constructive. And I'm assuming that this is one of the ways that you do it through this show and this network of trying to help people on dialysis.
Right. Well, see, in dialysis, I'll give it a little bit of a patience, and patients that are in a a chronic disease, mm-hmm. and there's very little support. In other words, they have social workers in these clinics. However, they just collect, want to make sure that the money's collected. But the psychiatric portion or the psychology portion of having patients dealing with this disease and the changes in their life is lacking. And also, if you put in people that train on our patients, in other words, they don't have any medical background, it's earn as you learn, it's caused a hostile relationship between, it's like them against us. And mm-hmm. I think that a lot of times the self-esteem, I've noticed, gets ripped away. Mm. And they have very little choices in what they have or what, you know, their decisions are. And I have to say the majority in this industry, patients do not have informed consent, nor can look at their records. So it's really causing harm to our.
I think we lost Arlene there. Arlene, you're
yeah.
gone, sweetie. Oh my goodness. Okay.
Well, I can say a little
well, now,
something
Dr.
if you
Abdul,
want.
You're gonna. Yes. Sure, you're going to have to talk to me now until she comes back.
I can do that. And
all
I
right,
certainly
good.
Have not worked in the world of dialysis. In fact, dialysis is one of the medical places I haven't done very much in. But I have worked with people who are HIV positive, and I know how important it is to be a partner with your medical provider and how important it is to be able to feel like you have choices and have power. So just hearing, you know, what she just described, I can just imagine how difficult that must be for the patients to feel so unempowered and feel like they don't have any way to access power, that's not going to help them deal with the disease that they're feeling. And it just seems to me like these days, especially with these insurance companies, that the people
yeah.
who need the support the most, the people who are, I know as a psychologist, when I was in private practice and I took insurance, it just the hoops that people had to jump through, that these are the people who need help. And they're the ones that are
yes.
least able to jump through the hoops because they're in crisis. And I assume it's the same thing
mm-hmm.
in dialysis. But those are the people who get preyed upon then by these systems because they are weak.
Yes.
And they have so little support and they're in such dire circumstances. And it's just such a shame.
Yes. Well,
shame.
It is. You know, one of the things that I've noticed with these guests that Arlene has had on, these people that have been voluntarily.
Yay.
Okay.
Welcome back,
okay.
Arlene.
Yes. But that have been involuntarily ejected and then forced to go to the ER. This is basically the way I see it. This is a death sentence, and these people know it. That is a heavy
mm-hmm.
burden to carry. And
yeah.
what it must be doing to these people mentally to know that this has been done arbitrarily to them, it's been done for no other reason than they can make more money in that emergency room than they can in the clinic, and that they have
mm-hmm.
basically been handed a death sentence. I cannot imagine what goes through these people's minds. I just can't. Can you talk a little bit about what might be happening there?
Oh, totally unfair.
Yeah.
I would think that people would feel total despair. You know, one of the reasons why we have such wonderful things like hospice is the idea of giving people the opportunity to have a death on their terms, to have a dignified death. And so to be forced into these situations where you have no choices, that just brings people to a place of despair. And we know, no matter what's going on with you, the more negatively you feel, the harder it is for your body to fight and heal.
To respond, yes, yes. And we'd have to have a conversation about hospice because I got a whole different take on it, but that's for a different day.
The ideal.
But, so,
yeah, that's the ideal,
yeah.
not necessarily the reality. There are a lot of ideals out
yes.
there that don't meet up to the reality.
Right.
So my husband...
But go ahead, Darlene.
I was going to tell you, my husband's a dialysis patient, and he fears for his life all the time, and what these people have done to us, it's very wrong, and it's not right what they've been doing to my husband, and it's just very stressful, and how can I put it?
Who's speaking right now?
It's Karen.
I think Karen is, yeah. I was...
Yeah. Okay.
And after that, I want to go into a little bit of the background that it's actually a guaranteed public benefit for all patients with dialysis with no oversight, and that's part of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Karen is having an issue. She Well, I let her tell you. But they used to call the police, and they quit calling police because it's a suable offense. So now we use adult services, protective services. And it was a stroke, wasn't it, Karen? And I'll let you go on how that came about and what's happening now, the retribution and retaliation.
Yes, my husband had a stroke and stuff, and from their injections, and they, God, I'm so nervous. They have just like retaliated against us by I don't know, just doing mean things.
But you turned him into the health department, and that's where started the escalation. See, the thing is, if the patients cannot complain, if they do, they're retaliated against, and the industry has their own oversight and no accountability. They don't have to, because no matter where it goes back to them, be it Senator, White House, civil rights, or whatever. And these are really brutal places. New York, you have a lot of patients being terminated.
No, and they call the social or the adult protective services on me after they sit there and say that I take such great care of my husband because I have a problem with their injections of what they're giving Mark and stuff, and they just come back with this retaliation and hurt him, and it's just really scary, and Mark fears for his life all the time, and it's bad. And
it sounds horrible.
Yeah, it is. It's really horrible, and it's been happening for a long time. And we found Arlene Mullen to help us out as our dialysis advocate. And I've tried using the state to help us, and nothing happened there. I went into their network system, which they didn't help us out, and they sat there and said they helped us out. They never helped us out. The abuse and everything still continued to happen and still is happening like today. And they just do stuff just like telling me I can't be in the facility now because I was telling them to, you know, put my husband's feet down for his blood pressures on the ending and the beginning, because they always have his feet elevated up in the air, which a proper blood pressure in the beginning of dialysis, your feet should be on the ground and at the end. And also they have not done full rinse backs on Mark. They leave his blood and been throwing it in their biohazard with all kinds of blood. I've asked them to rinse his blood back further. And I guess that's why they came to their determination to not have me in there, in which my husband needs to be fed. And I usually fed him at a certain time and gave him his insulin. And now they're not allowing me to go in there. So I'm having to feed him at 4 a.m. in the morning and determine how much insulin I should give him so his sugars don't go low. Yeah, it's really bad. And
I think she had, I think the most important part of this, because I'm not as nervous, I just get lost on the phone, is the fact that from my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Karen, is that there is a medication that she said she didn't want used because it was not to be used on dialysis patients. It caused a stroke, and they just went ahead and did it.
Yeah, and Mark has already had a stroke, has had strokes, and they just go ahead and use it. And then I was lied to also because I asked another one of the doctors what they were giving to him because I was noticing his blood pressures being elevated. And she told me that he was only getting two vitamin D pills, and that was. And then later on, I found out they're giving him the injections of Mircera and iron, and and then when I told him to quit that, Mark felt great, huh, Mark?
Yeah,
he felt really good. And then that's when they really got starting to retaliate against us in, you know, coming and doing just horrible things on hurting Mark by injecting putting the needles in, hurting him purposely when, you know, they hadn't hurt him before. They were hurting him purposely, so we knew they were doing it purposely, you know. Mm-hmm. And
so how does one, and I, you know, I guess with us, this is not abnormal, this is not unusual. This is going on in many clinics with Medicare and everybody else knowing about it and doing nothing. And when you're terminated, that means you only can be treated in an emergency room where the ones mm-hmm. who terminated you are the ones who take care of you in the emergency room, and you have to be near death before they'll treat you. And then they make more money. They make up to $1 million per patient on the ones they got rid of. So how do we help the patients as far as how to deal with this?
Doctor, I've got a question. Yeah, I've got a question. Is there anything in your field as a psychologist and with your expertise mm-hmm. that could be applied to this? To benefit these people? In other words, is there a way they can intervene in this process they have going on? And it's all for money. It's where they can make the most money, where you can mm-hmm. cite the psychological damage and pressure put on these people by what they do to them. And, you know, to me, there should be charges against these people. This is mm-hmm. medical abuse for one thing, and then the psychological assault on these people. There's got to be a way, and my personal feeling being a guardianship antagonist, anytime APS is called into anything, it's bad news.
Mm-hmm.
It is just bad news. And this is the last agency you want to involve. The only one worse than that is CPS. But APS, mm-hmm. when it comes to ill adults, you know, who have chronic illness or age or whatever. Lord, don't let those people in your house. Mm-hmm. But is there anything, any avenue they could explore that where they could utilize the hardship that's been put on them, the pressure that's been put on them to stop this?
Well, what comes to mind first is the legal avenue. This sounds like something, and I am a psychologist. I am certainly not a lawyer. However, I've been an expert witness in domestic violence cases, and certainly psychologists could be expert witnesses in these situations, but this sounds like it's ripe for a class action suit. But one of the reasons why they're able to do these kinds of things is because they know that people fear joining such a thing because there'll be pushback. Mm-hmm. And there'll be abuse while this is going on. And we all know that these lawsuits can take years and years and years and years. But this sounds like something that should be a class action suit with lots of psychologists providing the expert testimony about the damaging effects of all the things that you've described on the phone call.
Yeah, it's bad. And the thing is no matter where a patient goes and complains, be it the health department, which Karen did, mm-hmm. I say that all the patients that we have come through our computer is complaints.
Mm-hmm.
And even the oversight says that every patient can complain free from retribution, retaliation, including termination, but they don't. They even put our patients on contracts, even if they've done nothing wrong. And I mean, it's just a nightmare, and I don't know how. I mean, I've been advocating, and I've seen people being taken off a machine because the nurse doesn't want her eating candy when the doctor said she could in a cup of tea, they called the police to take her off, but it's a private business. So they have to take them out. And this is what we have been dealing. I've been doing this 20 years. But the sad part is the majority of patients who were terminated are minorities.
Oh, wow.
They call the police on them, and the police escort them out, and they say, don't come back anymore. Blacklisting, blackball. I mean, it's all documented. But I just want to know how does one keep mentally healthy in these situations?
Oh, wow. That is a tall order. You know, what you're describing is horrific. However, we do know that we've people and populations, and the first thing that comes to mind is slavery. Certainly people were able to stay mentally healthy during horrific experiences. But it's certainly not easy. And it really depends on what kind of support you have. You know, the people who will be healthier are the ones that have a lot of outside support. And but without that, you know, what you described, it's just horrific. What I teach people to do is to reduce stress, and the stress reduction techniques, and I can describe a few of them during this phone call if you like, they are effective in lowering the stress. However, these situations that you're describing are going to constantly bring the stress right back up. So basically what you're doing is like playing ping pong. You know, you're lowering it down with some of these breathing techniques and other techniques just to keep it from going over the top as it gets raised again. But these are very difficult situations that you're describing, and I am wondering, have there been any lawsuits?
Why there's no lawsuits? Well, we have with Medicare, because Medicare pays for every person who doesn't have private insurance, and then it's only good for 3 years, and then they go on Medicaid. When they win something as far as malpractice or anything, we have been told it goes back to Medicare because they're the ones who had paid for the services. The only thing we can get is civil rights, and it looks like we have some strong cases of civil rights. But the hard part is, Dr. Q, is the fact that the lawyers, no one can believe this is happening. Even with Senate hearings we had in 2000 found our patients at risk, but a patient cannot even go to the White House. We have letters from patients to the White House begging for help from the White House to have them return to Health and Human Services. And then from Health and Human Services, they go to, and this is whether it's a governor, a senator, anybody, civil rights. It goes back to the networks, which are the industry, and that's because they have the contract for the federal government for patient care. So nobody can get out of this circle of violence. And the government and CMS is well aware and of this for 20 years and have done nothing. They help create behavioral contracts. That's 1 foot out the door. And they don't even have to be true. These are the most horrid. And the government pays for the care, private insurance for a percentage, just not a large percentage. But this government money, and the cheaper the care, the more profit they make. So it's not even going to patient care.
Yeah, because anytime you say anything, you're bullied in there, too, by everybody. It just seems like they all come after you. It's amazing how they do that.
Dr.
And then
Akua,
we
I
tried
have,
to get
I have
the,
a,
NX stage machine, and we were told that anybody could get that, but they denied us every time we've tried to do that too.
Wow.
Okay, Dr. Haku, I want to kind of come at this from a different angle here. Just as this lady was just speaking about the bullying that goes on by staff, and we see this in every aspect of where they have captured a segment of society, whether it's the elderly, the sick, or whomever. And I see it a lot with whistleblowers that come out of these federal agencies. The willingness of care providers or agency personnel to basically gang stalk, turn on, bully, harass, terrorize, participate in this. This is a question that always lingers in my mind, is what happened to these people that they would participate in such a thing and do it with joy in their heart, if you know what I'm saying? They enjoy what they're doing. Where did these people come from? I can't imagine treating another human being this way. But we see this in all of this federal agency, like I say, in the healthcare system, this bullying and terrorizing and intimidation, and these people seem to take pleasure. Where do these people come from? There's something wrong.
There is something wrong. And what comes to mind is the famous Milgram experiment, where a psychologist created a prison, basically, simulated a prison. And so some students were prisoners, and other students were the ones who watched over the prisoners, the prison guards. And they found that these perfectly reasonable people in this system, the prison guards, became sadistic. They had to stop the experiment, and now we couldn't even do something like that. They became sadistic because of the system. And so what you're describing sounds like a similar system, where the system is set up to reinforce the bullying of the weak and to then probably push out anybody that is not willing to take part in bullying the weak.
Right.
That's
sure
pretty bad.
The excuse I've heard constantly. Is that these people say, well, I've got a family I've got to take care of. Well, we all do, but I'm not going to do anything to hurt you to do that. But this just absolutely perplexes me. The willingness of so many people to participate, knowing they are causing that other person pain and terror and frustration, and in this case, in dialysis, like I say, basically handing them a death sentence, and you go home and go to sleep behind this?
Well, let me also add my psychological perspective to that. We know that from things like slavery and war, that people can, in their minds, create it so that other people are no longer human. Right?
Yeah.
That's how they indoctrinated soldiers, so that they will go out and kill other human beings. Right? And that's how the culture was for slavery, so that slaves were seen as less than human. I would imagine, again, I know very little. I don't have any personal direct experience with what you've been talking about in terms of the dialysis network, but from what you've described, it sounds like the culture, and to some extent the medical culture does that. People become bodies. You know, doctors do that. Many doctors do have that kind of God complex where they're focused on the body. When I worked in HIV, you know, we were constantly looking for doctors that were willing to partner with our patients, not to see them as bodies, to keep them alive. And I worked in HIV when the cocktails first came in, and doctors wanted the patients to take these crazy schedules of pills. And some of my patients just couldn't do it. But the doctors were insisting, because this is how to keep the body alive, not thinking about the quality of life, because doctors are also indoctrinated in their education to focus on that. So you take that, you know, a few steps further, and now you've got this whole system that sounds like it's indoctrinating people so that it is forgetting that people on dialysis are people and deserve a quality of life, and they become just these numbers and just these bodies sitting on machines as opposed to human beings. And the system perpetuates that. And the people who can tolerate it stay, and as I said, I'm sure the people who can't leave quickly and move on to something else. But then you have all these other people that are willing to stay and do that and keep the system going.
Do you know,
well,
this is one of the things, too, that you talked about the Stanford experiment. And, you know, this is one of the things I've noticed in this. When you give people this kind of power over another person's life, something happens to them psychologically. Something, and that experiment, I think, really brought this out. I think it terrified people. Because we saw the worst naturally come out. I mean, it seemed to be a natural progression seemed to come out in these people. And so I see this in the medical community. I see it in these federal agencies. I see it. You give people a sense of power, and it's like it drives them insane. But at what point do you lose your humanity?
Some of it is when I was trained. I remember I had my supervisor walk around with me that day, and she goes, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going to room 121, bed B." She goes, "No, where are you going?" And I remember this after all these years. She goes, "It's not a bed we're taking care of. What is the name?" Because
exactly.
I think in medicine, a lot of times, it's a bed. You know, you're going to go droplet in 32, bed 1, 32, bed 3. And that is how, more or less, you're trained. But this woman took me aside and told me, "No, what is the name? Remember that every person you touch is loved by somebody." And that has always stuck with me. But I think I think in dialysis, you don't have to have any background in medicine. You just earn as you learn, but yet you can't touch hair until you do 9 months and so many hours and take a test. But you can stick people in their lifeline, and the patients in most cases can't say no because we're a training facility. And then 18 months, Dr. Koo, 18 months they get to take their certification after all the learning on these poor patients.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like there are a lot of hospitals and clinics and so forth that, and I run an internship, so a lot of the time students learn while doing. It sounds like the real problem is who's teaching them. It doesn't sound like the people who are teaching them are like the person who taught you to focus on the human being, not the bed number. I'm sure these people are chair numbers or chart numbers, but not human beings, not with names and with stories. That idea that remember that every person that you are servicing has somebody that loves them, I don't think that the education these people are getting from what you described is that kind of education. It wouldn't be bad to be an educational facility if they were being taught in a loving way. But they're not. They're being taught to be abusive, and then they perpetuate that.
And you know what? Sometimes I think that they take their identity away. I remember one of my patients was an engineer, and he says, "Arlene, would you teach me how to do the machine?" I said, "Sure." So I taught him this machine. He goes, "I used to be an engineer." And I said, "You lost your kidneys. You didn't lose your degree." So I think I find that a lot of patients are stripped of their identity, period. Yeah. And it's like they're just sitting there. But the laws will change. I mean, we're making good headway, and it will be this year. It will go public. But it's just like how I have many patients that have told me they go 3 times a week, Dr. Koo. Let's say you're Monday, Wednesday, Friday. You go in there and they take your blood. Now, people are fretting on Sunday because they don't know who's going to be in their section to take their, to do their machine and take care of them and stick them. It might be a newbie. It might be somebody that has already caused you an aneurysm, which means, you know, they've blown up your vein. Mm-hmm. But you have to take them. Then you go home Tuesday, and you have half a good day, and then all of a sudden you're worried about who's going to take care of you on Wednesday. It's constant worry.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a patient, but this is what I'm told over and over, and I could see the fear of that too.
Sounds horrific.
You know what I find really weird too? Because the patients that go there join in on harassing whoever they're bullying.
Because they're fear. They're fearful. They don't want it to be them. Am I right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, their life, it's survival.
That's the reason why there were overseers during slavery, right? And certain people participated because they didn't want to become the victim, right? It's always, for some people, it seems to be more empowering to align with the victimizer so you're not the victim. And so what you're describing is people, if we are with you, then together we can be against them and then you won't turn on me. Well, hopefully you won't turn on me. I have a better chance that you won't turn on me.
Yeah, and I think when I started working, I came from a heavy lab background. I worked in laboratories for years, and I cross-trained into dialysis. And it was like the patients brought all food to us. And I thought, this is, wow, you know, they really appreciate what we're doing. And then I realized a lot of times it was out of fear that it's almost like, please like us, take care of us. And it was, I mean, that struck me as really odd. But as far as the slavery question, if they only make their money off the patients and they're immune from the Stark Law, which means everywhere you look, pharmacy, laboratory, vascular surgeon, no matter where you go, they own you. You can't just walk in across the street. And if you try and go into a clinic and say, you know, I'm looking for my mother, I'd like to see your clinic, you will not be able to go in there because who is your nephrologist? Mm-hmm. These are secret, but what is the definition of slavery? The only thing that's generating money for them are the patients. And they had, I mean, they had Epogen. They knew were killing patients. They went ahead and used them. Mm-hmm. What does the government do? They fine them, I think it was $55 million. They knew Granuflow was killing patients. What did they do? They got $355 million in fraud. But what about the patients?
Yeah.
That's their lives that are generating these huge profits.
Arlene, can I ask, do they, in this dialysis thing, do they offer therapy? Do they offer counseling for these people going through this?
No.
Or is this the community that drives through?
No
therapy, right? Mm-hmm. Your life hanging by
a string. Have social workers. You're supposed to be for provisions of coverage, you're supposed to have a social worker, a dietitian there. The social workers don't do anything but more than make bus schedules and collect money and sign patients up for money.
Yeah, social workers, depending on their training, may not be trained to do therapy. Social work is a different field. There are clinical social workers that specifically train in doing therapy, but most social workers, their job is to make sure that if you need a home health aide, you're signed up for that. If you need accessoride to get you to and fro, you're signed up for that. That's mostly what basic social workers do. So they wouldn't be doing therapy. And very often facilities like this want to save money, so they hire the least trained people they can. They're not going to be hiring psychologists that are going to charge them more to come in and provide actual therapeutic services, so they can kind of say they have social workers, and then And often people think that that means that there's going to be some therapeutic service, because many people think
see,
of course it goes that way.
Yeah.
But that's not what they really are about making sure you have, usually are about making sure you have those basic services, the excessive ride and those kinds of things. And unless they are clinical social workers, they usually do not provide therapeutic services.
I just can't imagine putting anybody. Go ahead.
The social worker at the clinic that Mark goes to, we've asked for her help, and she's done nothing to help us. I mean, she even offered us saying she was going to help for giving gas money to go to and from there. She never did. She's never helped us. I was like, what exactly does a social worker do? Because she doesn't do nothing, it seems to be.
Well,
you know,
well, that brings on a whole new thing. Thanks, Dr. Koo, mm-hmm. because I thought they were clinical social workers.
Again, I don't know any of these.
Well, no,
but
I think they're
generally, yes, that's what.
Yeah, social workers, yeah. So what about, it seems like if anybody needed something, they would never treat a cancer patient like this.
Mm-hmm.
And when your CEO of one company a few years back got $68 million on taxpayers' money, really, for a bonus, and that's just his, and that's not the other people.
Mm-hmm.
These are not about patient care at all. This is not about health care.
No, but one reason why they may not be able to treat cancer patients like they are treating dialysis patients is because cancer treatment has to stay medical, fully medical. You know, that there aren't any – these treatments that are chronic treatments, as what you've described, technicians that
right.
take 18, you know, months of training can do it. But you can't do that if you are doing radiology and those kinds of things. Those have to stay fully medical, and therefore
mm-hmm.
they don't have the ability, from my limited understanding, the ability
right.
to treat people as poorly as they are in this situation.
Well, there only needs one nurse has to be on the premises.
Mm-hmm.
There's no codes. They call the family in some cases to call 911. We've had I could go on after abuse, but for a
mm-hmm.
healthcare place that's giving life-saving care,
mm-hmm.
they took away all crash carts. They don't use crash carts. They don't even have an AFib because they are private businesses. They don't qualify
mm-hmm.
under JCO.
And again, just to because my direct understanding is so limited, I'm connecting this to the other things I understand, like private jails. Now, this sounds
mm-hmm.
like that same kind of privatization where things are now put in these hands where people are just focused on the money, and therefore inmates who are still human mm-hmm. beings, no matter what they did to get in there, they're still human beings, are treated just like flabs of meat. And because of the privatization, it sounds like what you're describing here.
Well, that and they give, it used to be where you had three patients, you got to know, I came where I worked for a hospital, dialysis,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
we had time to know the patients, know their families, talk about their grandchildren and give excellent care. The for-profits came in because they're immune from and went into business with the
mm-hmm.
nephrologist, and that is where the nightmare happened because they can profit off their patients.
Exactly.
But and then Medicare says, gee, we don't know anything about health, but we just pay.
Mm-hmm.
So they set up the networks, which are them, and to put our patients on contract and how to terminate a patient legally.
Mm-hmm.
You would never use that on a cancer patient.
No.
The press would be all over it. I don't know. I just, I don't know what to tell the patients. All I can say is hang in there. We're making headways into getting this cleaned up.
Mm-hmm.
But
how much has the press
human
been involved
life has,
in this?
Pardon?
How much has the press covered the situations that you described?
The police?
No, the press. Has the press been involved?
Oh, the press. Well, this is another thing. I've been New York Times, Washington Post when I first started, all the documents there. They're afraid of getting sued. There was 365 that did an article. They threatened them. Did an article, and he said, I don't think we can do it because of the liability. I said, I'll give you documents. And I sent him email so they could write it. But really, they've got it made because you go to the National Kidney Foundation. They sound pretty reliable, don't they? Check the boards. They had my information before we had our Senate hearing and did nothing with it. They used patients for lobbying because it's hard to turn away patients. And then when the press goes to the networks, the oversight, well, they're all the professionals. But every patient who is terminated, the network and CMS signs off on on their termination, but they never call the patient. So how can you be quality of care when the patient can't even tell you his side? Now they're blocking out advocates. And it's going to go, but who can believe this is happening? It's taken me I'm on my 21st year, and this year they promised me it's going public. It's going public. But how do you have the patients? And the patients tell me, Arleen, I want to live to see it. I absolutely want to live to see it. But you have to have the documents to prove it. I think 804, Marty.
Yes, hang on a Marty second there? Here. Let me open them up. Yeah. Here we go. Yes.
Yes, you're wrong here. You're wrong here. Good afternoon.
There you go. Good afternoon.
Everything you all talking about, I've lived it and going through it now. Just like tonight, all is on my mind. Who's going to be in my pod? Are they going to hurt me? Or whatever like that. I go through all of that every day. And I've been doing dialysis over 16 years. And it's always a bad night before because it's on my mind. Who's going to be in my pod? You know, and all I did was ask the FA a question. And now everybody's been retaliating me. Everybody's actions and emotions have changed. All of a sudden, everybody, you know. And I noticed that the girl that was a good sticker, now she have a problem. See, now they're retaliating against me already, you know, and I noticed it. Now I have to watch what they're putting in my needle. Just like you said, the Efogen, I tell I don't need it, you know. And I watch them when they're putting in my needle. And they turn my machine, I turn it so I can see it, you know. And now I'm more afraid what they're going to try to do to me next. Because I can feel, you know, the tension in the air when I'm there, you know. And instead of the administrator, she's hardly even there to know what's going on. And the charge
the clinic that that he's in terminated a civil rights icon, terminated her. Lomax, okay, go on. I'm sorry. I just want to know that this is a problem clinic for us. Go on, Jerome.
And,
I'm sorry.
And like you say, they don't give them, they bring them off the street, don't give them the proper training, and they expect you for to go along with that. You know, and then when you don't let them stick you, they have an attitude. And then when you ask a tech, would you let somebody come off the street to stick you? The answer is all of them, no. And why would you want us to? Yeah, and then they bring them in off the street to mess our arms up. And then when they finish, they go to the unit where they're going to be at permanently. I told them, you're using this as a training ground for to bring people in here to mess our arms up. And then they leave and go to the clinics where they're assigned. I'm saying that don't make sense. I've never let them. If they don't know already, I know how to stick. I don't let them stick me. And I'm known for that. I take care of my arm. I've been doing this over 16 years. That's how I have this longevity. And I know how to do the right things. And I know a lot about what I'm going through. They can get mad all they want. I'm not just there to sit in that chair. I know everything what they're supposed to do to me. You know, and how. They don't go through the right techniques and techniques what they're supposed to. They just do what they want to do. You know, you can Google it and pull it up, and they'll tell you the exact way that you're supposed to be put on and taken off the machine. And they in that unit, they never do it. It's no supervision. No supervision. They're on their own. Every day is a different act. Every day. Every day. The girl. Yes, it is.
Mark was used for them to train on a lot. They poked him, hurting him all the time, training people on Mark all the time, huh, Mark?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See?
They were always training on him.
Yeah. And that's not intelligent.
It hurts.
Yeah. And those are big needles they're sticking us with also.
Yeah. They're finishing nails. Size.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I guess getting back, you know, to bring this out, but is there anything, I mean, Marty, what do you think that,
well,
anything to help them bypass this?
Yeah, that's what I'm, you know, we've got to find a way. To make this mainstream, yes, and to get this out. These radio shows help, yes, they do. And, of course, these shows each week get bigger and bigger, and as more people tune in and listen and, you know, participate in them. But the thing is, we can't keep letting this system work like it does. And like I say, for me, in this particular instance, dialysis, it's life-threatening. Eventually, it is going to take their life if they don't get a transplant or if things go wrong. And to be jeopardized like this in a clinic, the mental pressure of that, knowing, Jerome, just what you talked about, you know what they're supposed to be doing. You know how it's supposed to be done. And mentally, the destruction, this is basically like standing up and having somebody point a gun at you, and every time playing Russian roulette with you. They stick you with that needle. They do it wrong. They give you stuff you don't need or want. They give you medications they know are damaging. Jerome, what goes through your mind when that happens? I mean, what's happening in your head? That's what concerns me. The physical aspect of it is bad enough. But what is it doing to you mentally?
I wear a cross around my neck every day in the house. Before she or he attempts to stick me, I kiss my cross. And I allow them to stick me, but I'm braced. So I can ignore some pain, but not particular sharp pain. But by knowing what they're doing, I'm stubborn. So they think they hurt me, but they're not. They're hurting themselves. Because they're afraid to hurt me because I don't let them do what they want to do. And they're mad because I know what they're doing. I tell them, don't go too deep. It's right on top. Things of that sort. I know exactly what to tell them. I tell them how to run my speed on my temperature. Turn my temperature down. Don't run me 500. Run me 450. I be telling them how to set my machine. I tell them how many kilos I want to take off. See, I learned all this as I've been doing dialysis. And I've never had a fluid problem. Why? Because I taught myself that. You know, I've missed dialysis for 9 days when we had this power outage. And when I go in, I'm under my target weight. How? Because I knew I was going to be dialyzed, so I didn't influence myself to drink a lot of fluid. I still took those 9 days. That's how I trained myself. They wanted me to teach there, but I couldn't because I take on a project I'd like to complete it. And I figured I couldn't, and then they wanted me to travel, and I didn't drive. So I had to turn that advocacy down, you know. But I know everything about myself, you know. They can get mad all they want, you know. I'm not the other ones that they allow them to play silly games with me. I don't play in nothing games, you know. I be cordial, whoever's in my pod. I don't know everybody because I'm not near anybody. I can't speak because they're not close to me. I only have four people in the pod. Those are the only people, if they're awake, I socialize with through the whole 3 hours of my treatment. You know? But they know that when they bring these new people in there, they don't even bring them near me unless they already know how to speak. And they still mad, and I've got over it because some people come there already know how to stick. They're in my pod sticking me. But they don't realize this person already knows how to stick. You're not going to train on my arm.
Mm-hmm.
One thing. And then again, what we've learned on the show Tuesday, our fistula is supposed to last a lifetime. I've had five. After we learned on that show last Tuesday that our fistula is supposed to last a lifetime, I've had five. Why? Because now all of a sudden we're getting clogged. Going to the vascular plant, unclogged. They all in cahoots with the dialysis unit. All of a sudden, these vascular cleaners just popped up. There's two of them in Virginia. And the people that's there, the people that left from there, there was the check sticking me. You can't win.
This is Dr. Akua. I'd just like to point out something really important that you said, sir, as you were talking about how you survived, because you sound quite strong and sane despite how insane making the system sounds. But one of the things you talked about was spirituality, that cross that you kiss. And the work that I do as a psychologist is really bringing psychology and spirituality together. Because I find that it's the way slaves survived, right? Many slaves survived by relying on some type of spirituality. And so I'd say one thing that people can do, in addition to, you know, the other thing you said is really just knowing yourself, knowing your body, knowing as much as you can about the situation and the machines and all of that stuff, in addition to that is really finding some mechanism to hold on to. For most of us, that's spirituality. It may not be the right thing for everybody, but finding something to give you hope, to give you peace, to give you trust, right? Because it seems that you rely on your spirituality to help you understand who can stick you and who shouldn't. So finding ways to do that, and that's one of the things that I do, is help people focus on their spirituality to get through whatever challenges they're going through in their lives. And I just want to say before, because I know we're running out of time, that I have a free gift for everybody that's listening. The free gift is a 5-day journey to inner peace. Now, this journey to inner peace cannot solve some of the problems that we talked about today, but it might help you tap into the spirituality or find some little thing that you can do to just lower that stress a little bit. It's like a vacation. When you go on a vacation, your problems are still there when you get back, but you've taken a break from them, and that lowers the stress so that you have more capacity to deal with whatever challenges you have. Anybody that's listening to the sound of my voice can go to draaku.com. That's draaku.com, and they can sign up for the 5-day journey to inner peace. It's completely free. And I hope that for some of you, it helps you find a little bit of peace in the midst of these horrific circumstances.
Thank you for your advice, Dr. Jerome. Out.
You're very welcome.
All right.
Thank you very much. Show.
Okay, Marty.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you,
Jerome. Cool. Yeah. We've got about a minute left here, Arlene. Dr. Akua, I want to thank you for coming on this evening. You were very informative, and it's great to talk to people like you that give some sign of positive hope in all of this, and at least some relief, if nothing else, a way to get relief. So I want to thank you for that. Arlene,
thank you so much, as always, for
bringing on the show and having your guest on. I want to remind everybody of the Whistleblower Summit taking place in Washington, D.C., July 28th, 29th. I got it wrong again, 29th, 30th, and 31st. I'll get it right. Probably next time this year, I'll get it right.
Thank you, everybody.
Yes,
thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Okay,
night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you again for having me on.
Okay,
thank you.
You're welcome. God bless you all.